webcam microphone.
Upload webcam microphone. Upload webcam.
At the age of 19 in 1962, she was a...
See, but I have the files. You know, I read this
really?
Up in the National Archives, and I read these other things.
I said to myself,
any of that guy,
how can that be
possible?
The brain,
you know, or the rest of the slab of choice, and I don't know when that was.
Internet,
yeah, okay.
Professional
wrestlers, and not Jesse Ventura style.
It doesn't matter where the cartoon goes from, as long as it's real.
It doesn't take
hard to get real information.
Because seriously, they don't want you to have degrees to resources whenever I try to prove out one of them.
No,
it's not.
You expect your government to tell you the truth, you're going to
sadly disappoint another one of these things.
Dear Lord, what a dirty old man, huh?
Really
now?
Be serious. Is this
really
how we want things to be?
Come on.
More hooker, you know, eruptions.
eruptions,
whatever.
Like Dave Powers kind of...
Really?
Allegedly broadcast live from FEMA Region 2. Within the borders of the formerly united and currently occupied states of America, we bring you the O'Shelley Effect.
I damn sure know I'm an original. We have all these situations. I'd love to know why it takes 50 years, you know, for...
That's that.
For a 19-year-old girl to eventually get up to gumption to put these things out.
Good evening, UCY.TV radio listeners. This is obviously the O'Shelley Effect, as that obnoxious bumper tells you. It is the 15th day of January 2015, and we are live. Anyway, thanks a lot for tuning in. Whether you decide to use your TuneIn app, your iTunes radio, your Shoutcast, or if you've just gone to UCY.TV/TOE, I really do appreciate all of you. Of course, we are going to wind up touching on one of my favorite subjects, actually my most favorite subject, which is the JFK assassination, but we're going to wind up in a couple of other interesting areas, including talking about the real science, the real forensic evidence regarding what occurs and how things line up with stories, scenarios, myths, etc. And my guest tonight is Sherry Feaster. I will join her in momentarily. Sherry is an interesting author and researcher because of her background, and of course I'm going to let her tell you all about that, but she is, you know, one of those people that that definitely I would pick to get a real scientific examination of what actually occurred in that whole situation in Dealey Plaza on November 22nd, 1963, because Sherry does have the type of background, the type of experience, the type of knowledge that'll help us, those of us out here trying to understand and interpret the evidence or the alleged evidence as it is, in a lot of different ways. You know, and here's the thing. When you, I was just discussing this with Sherry off the air, you know, and she made an excellent point that, that is always well worth repeating. You know, when you want to go to someone to get a job done, you usually go to someone who is educated in a particular specialized area. You generally go to them because they have the experience, the education, and the correct mindset in order to interpret the events, the facts, the scenarios, the evidence, as it were, regardless of what we're talking about. And of course, it is absolutely my pleasure to have Sherry Feaster on tonight. How are you doing tonight, Sherry?
I'm well. Thank you so much for having me.
I really do appreciate it. You know, this is the first time that you and I have really had a meaningful conversation. And, you know, I'm familiar with your work and have been familiarized with your work over the years because you've made different presentations that I've gotten generally recorded. I've actually not been in the same room with you, I don't think so, before. Although it is possible, Sherry. You never know.
I think you'd remember.
You know, it may be, but I'll tell you, sometimes I've been reminded by others that they have met me somewhere else before.
Okay.
You know, and it's very, very weird because I can keep track of exact conversations, you know. When I actually got to speak to Dr. Ebersol, I remember every single moment of talking to that man, you know, in the 1990s, actually the early 90s. And, you know, that was pretty interesting. Although I failed to get anything meaningful out of him, I definitely observed his nervousness with which I was asking questions. Of course, it was like using a sledgehammer to try and kill a fly because I did not have the proper medical knowledge, really, to ask him any poignant questions. It was just kind of happenstance that I ended up in the same place as him and wound up knowing him through someone else, et cetera, et cetera. So it was a weird situation, and that really did not turn out to be a fruitful interview in my history of interviews regarding this case. But anyway, let's put that all aside. So first of all, we'll talk about... you know, let's give everybody the title of your book and where they can get it, first of all.
The name of the book is Enemy of the Truth, Myths, Forensics, and the Kennedy Assassination. And it's available through my website at sherryfeaster.com, Amazon. It's available as Kindle and in some bookstores across the country.
Well, right, and definitely go to sherryfeaster.com because, you know, it's actually an interesting website, presents some interesting clues right off the bat for even the most novice of individuals trying to look at the Kennedy assassination. But like I said at the beginning of the program, which you probably didn't hear me say, but we're going to actually touch on a couple other subjects as well during this. But let's start with this book and why it is you came to write it. And all of that.
Well, I think when somebody decides to write a book, it doesn't just you don't just wake up one day and say, I'm going to write a book. I mean, most people don't. At least I don't. What happened with me was I had been working for many years in the field of forensics. I had a 30-year career with law enforcement as a forensic investigator, and I have a sister who is knee-deep in the Kennedy assassination. Her name is Deborah Conway, and she has JFK Lancer. She's one of the founders. And she, every time I would see her, I mean, she would say, when are you going to do something with the Kennedy assassination? Because I was an expert in three states, U.S. federal court, 37 jurisdictions, judicial districts. I had published in the field, spoke nationally and internationally, taught this, you know, and she was just convinced that if I would just look at the assassination and use the information that I had, that it would change something, that something would happen. I, of course, had absolutely no interest, none whatsoever, in the Kennedy assassination. Robert Kennedy was my guy. He would have been the first person that I could have voted for as president. And so that's where my interest was, not so much in Kennedy, John Kennedy. But
well, right. And, of course, it's worth noting once again that you can find a lot of the stuff that Deborah has done over the years. And we're talking a lot of years here. Almost 20 years, right. I was going to say well past a decade and a half, but almost 20 years now at jfklancer.com. Actually, if we go back and we decide to buy any of the old you know, programs from there, some of the presentations, you can actually find Sherry as part of those as well at some of the conferences mm-hmm. that occurred every November in Dallas there. So here's the thing. You had this, you know, you had this career, which,
right.
You know, technically, what is it that that you would say you are career-wise?
I was a forensic investigator. I investigated crime scenes, reconstructed crime scenes. In particular, I would do shooting events to reconstruct the shooting, where the shooter was located, the position of the victim, if there was any movement after. Oftentimes, even if the victim was not there, I could still determine the method in which they had been killed. I am an expert in blood spatter analysis. And so, you know, that was my day job.
Well, that's what I did. And this is important in a whole lot of events that have occurred, you know, historically significantly, even in the news recently. I mean, when discussing, say, like the Michael Brown shooting, you know, I got immediately upset with Michael Bodden and that guy that was doing the presentation with him, because their public pronouncements were really empty, and I knew that right away because of all the time I spent, you know, listening to people like you. I understood that. You know, without the recreation, okay, talking about the direction of a gunshot, talking about the trajectory of a missile, as it were, is really invalid without having a you know, a full sense of what occurred, right?
So, absolutely.
So you can't do it without, you know, basically doing some sort of a reconstruction. And this involves not only reconstructing, you know, say, the position of the victim, the, you know, the place from whence the missile was fired, you know, the caliber, the speed, all of these things. Were there any objects interceding the trajectory? Things like this all come into play. And this is not a matter of very simple, well, you know, it seems to have gone through the body this way, therefore it came from here. It's not that simple and never was. So that's my own little editorial on Bodden once again, who I'm just completely disgusted with. But anyway, my personal problem, not yours. But the thing is that when we start talking about the Kennedy assassination, people do discuss from whence, you know, the missiles came and all of that. And, of course, blood spatter is an interesting thing.
Excuse me.
Because this determines a whole lot about exactly the way, I mean, just to put it in a layman's sort of terminology, this kind of tells you how it all went down in a lot of ways. Because the way that the blood casts off, the way that it ends up falling, the way it ends up pooling, tells you a whole lot about the events that caused the patterns, right?
It does.
See,
but it doesn't speak as, it speaks in a very general way to trajectory. It, the way that it addresses trajectory is that it helps you to determine the directionality of the projectile. In other words, it helps you to determine from what direction was the bullet traveling from, but it doesn't, it'll give you a general idea, like from the front, from the rear, from the side, that type of thing. But it doesn't pinpoint something. But to determine trajectory, the first thing that you have, there's one of the things that you need to do is to determine the direction the projectile was traveling, and there's five ways to do that, and that's one of the five ways.
Well, right. I mean, but this is a key element in
Absolutely.
Beginning to determine the specifics, right?
It is a key element. It is. If you have blood on a scene, it becomes very important. It does. It can give you a lot of information. In the Kennedy assassination, the significance of the blood is directionality. Because we already know where he was. He was seated in a car. We know where he was. We know his body position. We have photographs of it. So, again, the significance of the blood spatter, it dismays me when people say, well, you're basing your trajectory on the blood spatter. No, I'm not. That is not the basis of trajectory. It's just a small part of it. An important part, but yes, but it's just a part.
Well, right, and this is the thing. I mean, when you have part of the reconstruction in hand, because, you know, quite often most murders are not photographed.
Absolutely.
You know, and here's the thing: in the JFK case, we do have photographs of the exact positioning when certain events mm-hmm. occurred. You know, and we also have a general idea when other events could have occurred, because you know, there is the problem with the Zapruder film where they go behind the sign for a little bit, so we're mm-hmm. not, you know, entirely sure what's going on behind that sign, but something seems to have happened,
right?
You know, and there is more than one event that occurs, you know, during this crime, so. Now, when taking a look at the blood spatter evidence, right, the first thing that usually is argued to me right away, of course, is that some of it was cleaned up. You know, because we've learned in, at least in recent years, almost for certain, that some of it was destroyed right away by a Secret Service agent who had cleaned up part of it, right? But it still doesn't quite hide the whole picture. And, I mean, I've seen, and I have, you know, the FBI and the Secret Service, both versions of the back seat of the limo, you know, the black and white and the color photographs, which
right.
Which, you know, I'm sure you're extremely familiar with and probably have a much better version than I do. But the thing is, there are certain elements there in that crime scene that that can't be obscured by simply trying to mop it up with a sponge. You know, and I wonder, you know, exactly what it is, you know, what it is you utilize to try and, you know, examine the blood spatter evidence. I mean, was it just those photographs or?
No. Actually, I used more than that. There's a lot of testimony, believe it or not. There is testimony concerning the amount of blood in the car and where it is. And I spoke firsthand to Frazier, who, Secret Service agent, that actually we talked about this on the phone. He described having his gloved hands pressed down in the congealed blood, pressing it against the carpeted floor so that he could find minute particles of the projectile. And I think that's a firsthand account that, I mean, we really have to think about that. We know that because of the testimony of Clint Hill that the blood was deposited upon him, and we know that it was behind President Kennedy. It was on motorcycle officers on both sides of the limousine and on the windshield and arm of the driver of the follow-up vehicle. We also know from testimony that, and from statements that I spoke with people, that there was blood all the way to the ornament on the hood.
What?
So there's a clear picture of where blood is located, and then you talk about what kind of blood are you looking at and what can it tell you. So, you know, looking at the overall general picture, it appears very consistent with me. I don't see anything that's misaligned. What we see in the Zapruder film is very much what blood spatter looks like. I know that that is not altered in any way. Absolutely could not be altered. And so having a little bit of the blood cleaned at the hospital certainly did not change the amount of information that was available for me to consider.
Well, although you've got to say that if they had not destroyed it, if they had preserved the scene without tampering with it at all, more information could have been gleaned from it, though, right?
Well, not in 1963.
Well, see, that's the thing. Not in 1963, right.
And not in 1973, and not in 1983. Not until after 1983, 20 years later, did people really start to look at blood spatter in the way that we do now. We did not analyze blood patterns like we do now. And, you know, I was doing this in the 1980s. And so I know as things progressed and what information became available. And I assure you, we could go in and analyze and absolutely do an analysis if we had the scene today and it was pristine, but it would not really change anything that we know.
Mm.
It wouldn't.
Well, okay. Now, the science has evolved, as have many different sciences evolved. I mean, we've gone through the whole thing with the neutron activation analysis, which, you know, doesn't prove anything.
That's right.
Although at the time, you know, it seemed to be acceptable, but not really. You know, it turns out there's a whole intrigue involving that, and people can look that up, you know, regarding the projectiles and things like this and exactly how bullet lead analysis is done. And there's been yeoman's work done on that as well.
Absolutely.
You know, but especially by a guy that I've already had on, Stu Wexler was part of that,
yes.
Talking about the, you know, of course, when I had him on, we were talking about the King assassination, but one of these days I really do want to do a show with him about the bullet lead analysis, because from a statistical point of view, it turns into nonsense. you know, regarding this neutron activation analysis. And so the science has definitely evolved. And based on that, you know, we got to learn things, you know, a quarter of a century later, essentially, that we would not have known, even if the scene, like you said, had been preserved in 1963.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and this is a key element. But let's talk about exactly what it is that you did learn from actually deciding to, you know, to look at it. Because, after all, like you said, you really weren't all that interested in it. You know, and Deborah, I can definitely see why Deborah would have been pushing you to look at it, because there is a serious lack of scientific research going on in the community, in my estimation, you know, regarding these events. There's a lot of supposition. There is a lot of, you know, attempts to tie, you know, various, I'll be kind and call them fairy tales, to bits and pieces of anecdotal evidence, as opposed to looking at the pure science of the event. You know, and one of the biggest things that that kills me all the time is, like, say, the belief in a, you know, in the whole James Files scenario. It's implausible, not based on where James Files was or who he had access to or what weapon he used. It's implausible because the story absolutely does not match the forensic evidence as it exists, you know, in my opinion. Now, you know, like I mentioned this to you, you know, like I said, we had a brief conversation. I disclose, you know, anything that somebody doesn't tell me, you know, don't disclose this on the air, you know, because I don't believe in holding stuff back. But this is one of my main aggravations regarding, you know, some of this mythology, is that people take, you know, bits and pieces of what they believe are the forensic realities here, and they tie it to some of these stories. And the next thing you know is, I mean, you've got people running around out there with, you know, 12, 13 shooters, you know, firing anywhere from, you know, 14 to 18 bullets, you know, striking the car all over the place and everything else, and the actual existing evidence doesn't match any of this.
Well, you're absolutely right. And I'll tell you, when I first looked at trajectory analysis, I didn't expect to do anything but prove that there was a grassy knoll shooter. I mean, seriously, when the only reason that I did the trajectory analysis is because once I did the blood spatter analysis to explain what the blood was in the Zapruder film, why it looked like that, and why it was not tampered with and absolutely was authentic, that one frame of the Zapruder film is absolutely, without a doubt, authentic. Now, I'm not going to speak to the rest of the film. I don't really care about the rest of the film, but I'm just going to say that frame absolutely is authentic. There's no way that it could have been painted in. Not that the ability to paint it in wasn't there, but the knowledge to know what to paint in was not there. So,
right, and we're talking about frame 313 here, which
absolutely
is where we see the explosion of Kennedy's head. This is the single frame where there is particulate coming out of his skull, just for, mm-hmm, you know, radio listeners and those that aren't familiar. You know,
right,
this is the key frame, and this is, of course, you know, the frame where the headshot occurs. And I do say the headshot, by the way,
right,
because there is not more than one headshot.
Absolutely
now,
not.
We can argue over whether there was, you know, a shot to the, you know, the back or the neck or whatever based on the photographs that have circulated and things like this. But in my estimation, there is one headshot. Now, at least to Kennedy, there is one headshot. You know, as far as what hit Connolly and everything else, this is a whole other story. But the thing is, we can see that. And here's the problem with it. Now, a lot of people would think that that there would be more than one Zapruder frame that would show this spray, this, like, very obvious spraying of matter coming out of Kennedy's skull, right?
And when you look at a really good copy of the Zapruder frame film, you see more than one frame.
Well, that's precisely correct, is when you actually, you know, because I'm one of these nuts who actually had the, you know, the single frames printed up and all that at one point, and there is evidence of it in more than one frame. But
sure,
even without that, if there was only, you know, only the spray during the one frame. Here's something that a lot of people don't understand about the optics involved there, and that is that the reflective quality of the matter that is there, there could easily be more than what is being represented on the film. And this is something that, you know, I've gone over a lot of times, and of course I get laughed at because I'm the guy who, you know, can't see very well. But the thing is, I've had these frames blown up to life size and projected. You know what I mean? Not the frame itself, but I mean projected life size, so that I could examine these things, you know, to the utmost degree that I could. And what you're seeing there is a representation of what could have been seen with the human eye. It's not entirely accurate. It's not quite as textured as a, you know, as if somebody had their smartphone out today and the Kennedy assassination occurred today, we'd have a much better film, you know. But
absolutely, we would. And let me tell you something, just to interject a little bit right here.
Please do.
When you teach blood spatter analysis, every person that learns how to do this, to become an analyst, you have to create standards, which is examples of every different type of pattern. And you create patterns with lots of different types of ammunition and weapons and with movement and all kinds of things. And you have to film it. You have to photograph it. And you have to maintain those standards in order for you to work as an expert in this field. The difficulty in capturing blood spatter on a video camera, today's video cameras, and do it at a shooting range with a grassy background is almost impossible. So what you have to do when you're teaching is you go in and you build these big frames and you hang black sheets or white sheets so that you can actually visualize the blood. Because otherwise, it's lost in the grass. You can't see it. So am I surprised that you can't really see it very well? Not at all.
Yeah, well, see, that's the thing, is the contrast is what would actually show you on that film where, you know, there would clearly be a longer, I mean, it's not a huge amount of time. It's not floating out there for 10 seconds, and it's not out there in a cloud. But
that's exactly right.
But the thing is that it would occur for more than that fraction of a second that's represented on the Zapruder film. Physically, it would be out there a little longer.
About three frames.
That's where it should be, right.
Yeah, about three frames. That's all you should today, in today, using a really high-speed camera, we can capture it for what would be equivalent to about three frames on the Zapruder film.
Well, right, and this is why when and I'm sure you've looked at this stuff where, you know, they've done the whole test firings through skulls with the paint in them. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah, that's just not valid.
It's absolutely invalid. I wonder if you want to tell people why that's so invalid, because my explanation, you know, again, I'm not an expert on this, but just looking at it from a common sense point of view is that, you know, paint is not going to be the consistency of blood, and a living and live skull is not going to react to a bullet round, you know, a bullet the same way that you know, an encased, covered with skin, living, breathing, you know, skull is going to react when hit by a projectile. So for two reasons, you have a completely invalid representation of what the human skull would be like on a living person. And and then, of course, you have the problem of filming it and all that other stuff. And on top of it, let's just not forget that it's not attached to a neck. Okay, yeah. These were sat on a ladder or whatever they were using at that time. I think it was a ladder to film and demonstrate exactly, you know, why the head snap was the way it was and all this other nonsense. But realistically, you're starting with a poor model to begin with, right?
Absolutely. I mean, we don't have to do that. You know why we don't have to do that? Because lots of people get shot in the head. And we can do autopsies, and we can work the crime scenes. So we know what happens. We may not have a film of it happening, but we study the aftermath, and that speaks volumes. And So coming in and saying this, you know, going on a crime scene where someone has been shot with a weapon that we know where the shooter was located, we know where the victim was, we know the caliber of the weapon, we know where they were struck, and then trying to manufacture that in some attempt by sticking some kind of artificial skull and artificial blood and tissue and all that in there and try to recreate that, it doesn't look the same. Well, it just doesn't look the same.
Right.
So do we want to trust? Do we want to trust what we know to be life and what happens when people are really shot? Or do we want to trust what somebody has determined that if I do this and stick it on a ladder and shoot it, I can decide what really happened?
Well, see, and some years ago, right, there was this documentary that was out, and I know that you've got to be familiar with this. I've never asked you about this, but I'm sure you are. You remember the JFK inside the target car thing?
Oh, yes.
Okay. Now, They supposedly had these forensically accurate models that they utilized, and then they fired, you know, virtually the same type of ammunition through the same type of weapon, et cetera, all of this nonsense, right? But these things that are supposed to be these forensic dummies are still not human bodies.
And not only that, but they were filled with gel, not a liquid.
Right.
Let's just start with that. How can you do blood spatter with something that's filled with gel? It's not a liquid.
See, and I know it's got to bother you when you see like this being represented as.
Yes, because let me tell. I don't mean to speak over you, but let me tell you the big problem with that particular. I'm going to use this in a very loose way. Reconstruction. This is what they did. They went to some really great people and experts. That I know, and said, we'd like for you to do this a little analysis. And then they took their dummy and they shot the dummy with their fake blood from the rear. And then they brought the expert in and said, where did the gunshot come from? And the expert, being an expert, said, from the rear. Aha, they said. That means President Kennedy was shot from the rear. No, that only means that what you did came from the rear.
Yeah, your dummy was shot from the rear, and the expert told you so.
Exactly.
Big surprise.
Yes. They did not state that they looked at a blood spatter pattern that was even similar to the one that was there when President Kennedy was shot, because nobody can recreate that. They brought in people that looked at the vehicle, glanced at it, 30 years prior, and said, oh, yeah, that's exactly what the pattern looked like. Excuse me. But nobody can say that a pattern is similar to another pattern unless they are an expert and they have the training to do that. These people saw blood, yes. And they saw blood a second time, yes. But does it mean that the pattern was similar? No. And so the Discovery Channel and the people that produced that show really used, manipulated, and deceived the people that were watching into thinking that the experts were saying that President Kennedy was shot from the rear.
You know, and here's the amazing thing, too, is that for a long time, that was like a couple of years on the internet of trying to explain to people how fraudulent that presentation was, because they touted it as, you know, the solution. We found that the Warren Commission got it right, and this is the way it is. Now, I'm not saying that everything in the Warren Commission is absolutely a fraud, but their conclusions are ridiculous in most places.
Well, you know, There's a couple of different things for that. Number one, do I think that the Warren Commission had confirmation bias? Okay, let me just start with that. Confirmation bias, for people that don't understand, is that they make a decision and then they find evidence to support it. And that's what the Warren Commission did. They said, this is what happened, and now let's find evidence to support it.
Yeah, it sounds like a very large number of authors on the case, too, by the way, do exactly the same thing.
But the good thing is that they also documented some information. The church committee documented information. The Warren Commission documented information. The House Select Committee documented information. Some of the information we can now interpret in a different way because we have made great strides in the last 50 years in science, in medicine, in forensic studies that look at ballistics and wound ballistics or terminal ballistics. All of those things have changed now. The things that we didn't know in 1963, we now know. They had no way of knowing what the future would bring. So they just put it down as it was, and then they made their interpretation of it. But now we can go back and look at that same well-documented information and interpret it against the standards that we have today and come to a more accurate conclusion.
Right,
that's what my book does.
Is the most fascinating part about your book is taking the existing evidence that is well documented from the 60s and bringing it into the modern scientific age, because this tells us a whole different story than they could have even possibly told us in 1963.
Absolutely. You know, one of the things in my book is information that talks about the forward movement of President Kennedy. You know, a lot of people say, well, there's two headshots because we can see a small forward movement followed by a larger rearward movement. But in 2008, a guy by the name of Karger, a German, published a book that talked about what happens when a projectile strikes a target. And when that kinetic energy is initially transferred to the target, it moves forward slightly into the direction of fire before it moves backwards. And the greater the transferred energy, the more pronounced that forward movement. That was in 2008. And then in 2011, Robert Copeland from the U.S. wrote a book called Wound Ballistics Basics and Applications. And he actually filmed this. And there's photographs in the book that show that forward movement. So how could they have possibly known when people were looking, like Josiah Thompson was looking at that forward movement and saying, well, it's got to be two gunshots almost simultaneously. Well, there was no way for them to look into the future in 2008 and 2011 and know that that is actually what happens to every target
when
struck by a bullet.
Right, and for those who don't understand what this means, here's the problem. Okay, we have established already during this discussion that at frame 313 on the Zapruder film, which is the most accessible thing out there that you can see, you see the explosion of the matter from Kennedy's head. Now, there is a massive and dramatic, you know, snap backwards of Kennedy's body after that. However, if we take a look at it, there is actually a slight forward movement prior to that. And then they tried to tell us for a long time that this was a neuromuscular reaction that, you know, that causes this to happen. But the neuromuscular reaction they were citing for the longest time was not really valid. Of course, and they presented us with films of goats being shot and things like this to try and show us exactly how this works. But the fact is there is a slight movement forward, and then the dramatic, violent, you know, back and to the left, you know. This is the way it goes. Now, what is it that changed, say, from, you know, the time that the American public first saw this, you know, in the mid-1970s when Grodin had brought the Zapruder film onto Geraldo Rivera's show, and the American public for the first time, really on a mass scale, got to see that that dramatic, you know, backwards head snap, you know, from that time to now, what changed actually, you know, regarding this? I mean, well, we discovered that the transfer of kinetic energy is not necessarily a straight line, because as you stated, you'll find that that there's a move toward the source of the gunshot, basically, right?
Mm-hmm.
And then the kinetic energy causes the movement backward. So
right.
What does that tell us exactly about what we're seeing on that Zapruder film?
Tell us that it tells you that you are looking at a single gunshot from the front.
Mm.
The big question is, where's front?
Right, because here's the problem. The grassy knoll shooter scenario, right, would require a shot from the side, okay,
right.
Effectively. You know,
you're right.
I'm putting it, you know, in as simple a term as I can, but I mean, basically, you have the right side of Kennedy's head exposed to the shooter's perch where it would be, you know, from, say, the stockade fence or even the, you know, the retaining wall there, one or the other. Either way, what you have is a shot that should have carried him to the left, you know, his left, as it were, effectively, because he is struck from the right. You know, with the way he was oriented. So what we don't see really is evidence of that. Now, there have been people over the years who have claimed that, that you know, that there are two headshots and they're almost simultaneous, okay? And this is one of the things that, you know, even if you go to sherryfeaster.com and you click on something called The Myths, okay, you can see this brought up on the list of myths, and we'll get to the whole thing. But This kind of covers two things here on your list, right? You know, there are two simultaneous headshots and the fatal headshot originated from the grassy knoll. Both of these things are not in evidence from a forensic standpoint, are they?
No, they're not. They really aren't. Let me talk. You know, one of the things that I talked about earlier was determining the projectile direction.
Right.
There are five ways. You look at beveling, which is the only thing that was considered by the early investigations. But second to that is fracture sequencing of bone, movement of the target, bullet fragment distribution, and blood spatter.
Mm.
Now, all five things need to be utilized in today's world to determine the directionality of a bullet. Now, we know that the only thing that they used was beveling. The problem with beveling is that it used to be like the gold standard.
Conical chipping. I'm sorry, can we just describe what beveling is for the listener?
Yes. It's a conical chipping away at bone that allows you to determine the direction of impact. So if you see the chipping away, then it tells you that you're looking at the exit side of the bone. If it's very smooth edged, then that's the entry side. And so what they would do for many, many years is look at the beveling, the conical beveling in bone, and to determine whether they were looking at an entry or an exit point.
Mm-hmm.
Which makes a lot of sense, okay?
Well, and this makes sense shooting through a lot of solid objects, right?
Yes, it does.
I mean, what happens is that when you put a bullet through, you know, let's just say a piece of wood, okay?
Or glass.
Or glass, either way.
Mm-hmm.
What happens is you have a very smooth, very tight sort of entry for that
mm-hmm.
bullet. So the side that the bullet begins to travel from is actually the very smooth, very sort of round bullet hole, easy to see, you know, that's it. The surface is not disturbed otherwise. However, once it exits that hard object on the other side, like you said, it's a conical sort of, what's another way to describe that? When you countersink a screw, okay, you end up with a beveled kind of effect there so that the screw goes mm-hmm. deeper into the thing. That's on the exit side of the glass or wood or bone in this case. Now, that was the standard for a long time. That was how you could determine exactly, you know, which way the bullet went into the skull and came out of the bone, right?
Mm-hmm. That's correct. And then in 2012, as people begin to do more and more work and research with wound ballistics, a guy by the name of Levi determined that sometimes that beveling would be wrong. So they couldn't consistently reproduce beveling that was accurate.
See, it would be an indicator, but not definitive, right?
It's not definitive. That's right. We can look at beveling, we can look at it and say, this is either an entry or an exit, and what else can help us to determine which it is? But you can't look at beveling alone and say, this is definitely an entry wound, not since 2012. Well, we're only talking about literally 2 years ago, because we're still in January of 2015. So 2 years ago, we learned this. Mm. So if the forensic community did not know this until 2 years ago, of course they didn't know it in 1963, and they used it because that's all they had to go with. So they went with the information that they had. But there's other things besides that. So we look at fracture sequencing, and that's the patterns in the, I'm going to use this in a very, very unscientific manner, but it's like the little cracks that are created in the skull when somebody is hit. And it doesn't matter if they're hit with a hammer or if they're hit with a projectile. The same kind of patterns are created. So the first thing that happens is they move from the point of impact away in the continued direction of travel in these long lines. And those are called radial fractures. They extend from the point of impact.
Well, right. That's literally why they're called radial, because they radiate from the
out.
Point of impact, on the skull. And as you stated very eloquently, it doesn't matter if you were struck with a rock or if you were struck with a bullet. If you have a fracture of the skull at a particular trauma, a concentrated area of trauma, it creates a radiating set of cracks. I mean, very much like, again, we could think of it like a piece of glass. You know, if a rock hits a piece of glass, if a BB hits a piece of glass, and you see fractures in the glass begin to radiate out from that, where do they first radiate out from is exactly the point of impact, creating that's almost like a spider web effect later on. But essentially, because of the long nature of these things that emanate from it, you can then begin to determine what the pattern of the fracture was to know what the initial point of impact is, even when, say, pieces of the skull have been ejected, as was the case with the Kennedy assassination, right?
Right. That's right. And do you know that that did not really come into real research until the 1980s? It was first published in 1987. And so since 1987, we now know that radial fractures are created from the point of entry, and they travel out like a spider web from that point. And they travel faster than a perforating bullet. So if a bullet is going to enter and then exit the head, the radial fractures are complete while it's still in the head. That's how fast they are created. The bullet is still in the head. And they are created. And then they also have concentric fractures. Those are the ones that go around like in a little circle. And each one of those are called a generation. And they're much smaller and closer together at the point of entry. And they're further away as they get further away from the point of impact. So now we can look at fractures in bone and determine where the entry point was. And that is something that they didn't have in 1963. So they didn't know that they couldn't trust beveling. They didn't know that movement, the forward movement, would make any difference if they could have seen it. And they certainly did not know about fracture sequencing.
Well, right, and I didn't even hear about this kind of discussion, you know, in the Kennedy research community until the late 90s regarding, you know, what the sequence of the fractures in the skull would have to be. But as you stated, you know, in the forensic sciences community, you had access to this knowledge in the late 80s, you know,
right.
Taking a decade for us to get onto it, you know.
There's always a trickle-down effect.
Right.
There's going to be a trickle-down effect, absolutely.
And, you know, and this is where I first heard a term like Pupfis phenomena, brings that is the idea of you can tell which fractures occurred first if you can reconstruct the skull, which is part of what needs to be done also during a forensic investigation, right?
Right. That's correct.
You know, when you do that, you can then begin to determine where the fractures began, the points of trauma that occur, and all this other stuff. Now, you obviously
Let me just jump in here with something. So if there would be two headshots, you would have two sets of radial fractures.
Right.
But you don't.
Right, that's what the problem is. We have one set. We have the skull basically coming apart like a cracked egg, you know, eventually, which becomes a confusing puzzle to most people, but actually it ends up making a lot of sense to somebody like you.
Right. It really does. And I know this sounds so strange, but I tell people all the time, I do not really see as many inconsistencies as they may see because I really know this. I lived this. You know, and been to a lot of autopsies, worked a lot of homicides, lots and lots of shootings. And there's not anything unusual about this case to me. This is just a homicide. It's just an open homicide.
Well, what is unusual from the autopsy standpoint, in my opinion, again, is that it was rather incomplete and rather inconsistent.
Oh, absolutely.
It was a badly done autopsy.
Absolutely.
You know, so you don't have, you know, the great documentation there. You know, thank you, Dr. Humes. the documentation is a mess regarding the autopsy. But even with that, what evidence do you use, though, to determine this? Because, see, I've heard this argument before from people that, you know, absolutely will not, you know, hear anything outside of what the Warren Commission had to say. So I'm going to present it to you and let you at it. You know, they say, well, you know, you can't make these kind of determinations about the bone because that would be a forensic determination, in which case you would require the bones themselves to make the observation. Now, it's my opinion that the x-rays, even as they stand, and the original x-rays don't look as good as what most people get their hands on because, of course, they're more used to the enhanced ones. But even the x-rays as they stand do show the majority of what it is you're talking about to be very consistent. Of course, there's other bits of evidence that you use to sort of put this together, you know, regarding your observations. But I wonder what you have to say about that, you know, regarding whether you actually need the bones. I mean, that would be the best case scenario, obviously.
Absolutely. Of course it would. But here's the deal. Again, let me go back to something else that I said. Because they did not recognize the significance of what they were saying, we can use some of the things that were documented. I mean, listen, they didn't fake what they didn't think would be a problem. They didn't get rid of it because they never dreamed what would 30 to 50 years of forensics bring. The Kennedy autopsy report states multiple fracture lines radiate from both the small defect and the smaller defect at the occiput. And what they're saying is that there were radiating lines from both the front and the rear. Now, the longest line radiated from the front, and the Clark panel made that very clear. They actually said that it was from the bony structures from the midline of the frontal bone moving anteriorly to the back, to the vicinity of the posterior, the rear, margin of the parietal bone behind. So,
right. Well, let's just clarify a couple of things really quickly. Sorry, Sherry. But the thing is that when we're talking about the Clark panel, this was in, I think, 1968, when Ramsey Clark, who was the Surgeon General at the time, right?
Right.
Actually decided to re-examine the medical evidence, and they did a panel of experts that would take a look at this and sort of just go back over it one more time. And even they established that you have a point of trauma, like we were talking about, toward the front of the skull, and then you have another point of trauma at the rear of the skull, which is completely consistent with a missile having traversed the entire skull, right? So a bullet would have gone in and out, okay? And when you said the occiput, by the way, the occipital bone is that little round piece of bone on the back of your head there, that little bump. Mm-hmm. That's the occipital bone in the skull, by the way. So when you're talking about this and you're giving directionality now, you know, regarding anterior and posterior and all that, but just to keep people, you know, fully understanding what we're talking about here, you're saying that you see from their own evidence that there is a greater amount of these radiating fractures from the front of the skull, essentially, and then you see another amount of radiating fractures at the rear of the skull, which absolutely, I mean, well, not absolutely, let me take that word back, but indicates just from that forensic examination that there is a shot from the front which exits from the rear of the skull, right?
That's right. And when you say, and when I say, you're saying exit, I'm saying impact. It doesn't have to exit. It just has to impact it. If you take a hammer and you whack someone in the head, it doesn't penetrate the skull. It still creates the fractures. So you could have an impact to the inside of the head at the rear, and you would still have fractures that were created. The difference is the secondary fractures will not go beyond the initial fractures. So you can look at those two patterns and say, oh, absolutely, this is the first one, and then this is the second one. And that's what the Clark panel carefully described for us. But because it wasn't the 1987 yet, they didn't know what to make of it. So they just went along with the rear shot.
Well, right, because based on what they understood at the time regarding this, it could have made sense either way. And so, therefore, they adopted the position, of course, that it was consistent with the single headshot having come from the rear, or having, you know, entered from the rear, let's just say, although you do have these two points of impact, and you're right by correcting me, of course. But the thing is that when comparing the two, this is when you can determine, well, this is the initial point of impact based on the characteristics of what caused the impact. Right, because we do know it was a bullet, after all. You know, as for which bullet it was and for which direction it came from, well, this is what we're sorting out. But this seems to be fully consistent with the idea that there was a single gunshot from the front, essentially.
Absolutely. In fact, when the Assassination Records Review Board interviewed Gerald Custer, in 1997, now he is the x-ray technician that was on call at Bethesda Hospital the night of Kennedy's autopsy. He's the one that took those x-rays. And in his testimony, they asked him specifically if it was his opinion that the trauma to the head began at the front and moved towards the back of the head. He answered them, yes, absolutely. So by 1997, they knew that.
Mm-hmm.
See, 1997 testimony, the testimony had changed. So, you know, we can look at that, the beveling, the fracture sequencing, the movement that we've already talked about, and the blood spatter that we've talked about. The only thing we haven't really touched on that helps you determine directionality of a projectile is the bullet fragment distribution. The bullet fragments that we see inside the head.
Mm-hmm. See, now, again, we have to kind of look back at the x-rays, right? Because this is the only place where we have a really good indication outside of testimony and that god-awful autopsy report regarding what actually, you know, where are the pieces of these, you know, projectiles, right? Now, it's kind of understood that there are pieces of projectiles that end up in the car, okay? Mm-hmm. But they are not in, you know, they're not, they don't account for the whole of the bullet, first of all, regardless of which shot you think those were from, okay? They don't account for a whole projectile. Also, the single bullet theory, as it were, you know, this is also a strange thing. Because after all, we know that not very much of that bullet was, you know, distributed anywhere else, if that is in fact the correct piece of evidence, which of course is questionable too.
Yeah.
I wonder if you want to talk about that a little bit, and also get into, you know, where it is we see the distribution and how it is we see it, but kind of go into the single bullet a little bit too.
Yeah, I'd like to do both of those. Since we're talking about the direction of travel, everything that we've talked about thus far, with the exception of beveling, has shown us that we're talking about a shot from the front. Mm-hmm. So the bullet fragment distribution, I'm not going to say that there's not questions concerning the x-rays. I mean, I would be foolish to say that there are not questions. However, we not only have questions, but we have testimony, and I mean the x-rays, but we have testimony. And I will tell you that when you have a fully jacketed projectile, it doesn't usually fragment. Now, a projectile designed to fragment is going to leave like what we see in the x-rays that we have. And they are very small, and they can have like a snowstorm appearance. That's what a lot of people have used before, so that should be something that our listeners are familiar with. But that pattern, the distribution pattern, identifies a projectile's direction of travel. So when the bullet enters the head and it fragments, then it's kind of like a little, think of a shotgun. It has an ever-widening path that it moves out in 360 degrees as it moves forward from the entry wound. So when you look at an x-ray that has lead fragments in it, if you're looking at it from the side, it looks kind of like a V. And so you can see that conical shape. Of course, that's just two-dimensional. It would actually be three-dimensional. But the apex or the point of that pattern is closest to the entry wound. And that we did not really know until the 1990s is when that really started to be published in a big way. So when the House Select Committee had Larry Sturtevant testify about the metallic fragments that he got to actually see the x-rays, he said, you'll see a cloud of metallic fragments very near the entry wound. Mm-hmm. And that the pattern that they leave is very small. They don't move very far from their initial place. And so they're very closely clustered around the track of the bullet, which is exactly what we see described in President Kennedy's x-rays. The Clark panel actually said, distributed through the right hemisphere, the right side of the head, are numerous small, irregular metallic fragments, and they, majority of them lay anteriorly, which means the top of the head, and superiorly towards the front of the head. Mm-hmm. So the Clark panel actually says most of those little fragments are at the top and the front of the head, and that they don't see any on the left side of the brain, and they don't see any below a certain point of the head, which is the anterior fossa of the skull, which most people are not going to be familiar with that. But there are a couple of larger fragments, because of their weight, would have gone further, and they actually talk about them. But AARB actually has that information in there. So the significance of the statement in the Clark panel report is that the front top portion of the head is the beginning of that pattern, the apex, the point of that little pattern that's created. So we know that the bullet entered at the front. And the point that they describe of where it's located is very, very similar to the point that the Warren Commission, Dr. Angel pointed out as the point of exit, because he saw a little spot that had some beveling, and he said, well, that's the exit wound.
You see, Dr. Angel, yeah, Dr. Angel was actually one of the people that was taking care of the analysis for the HSCA, I think.
Right. But I'm sorry, I misspoke.
No problem. But here's the interesting point about that is that once again, though, you still have the consistency of the forensic evidence as the science evolved, showing us the shot from the front. Now, what of course the criticism is right away is, now people have seen some of the autopsy photographs. Now the autopsy photographs that have circulated around are actually from for lack of a better word, a bootleg set that a guy named Fox, who was a Secret Service agent, had initially sold to a researcher some years ago,
mm-hmm.
and I went out of my way to get my original copies from the negatives, you know, and all that. I'm sure you've done the same. but the thing is that when we look at that and what's often referred to as the stare of death photograph, mm-hmm. where you can most profoundly see the front of Kennedy's face, you don't necessarily see a lot of evidence, even in the better copies of those photographs. You don't see a lot of evidence for that entry wound, but there is some, isn't there?
Yes, there is. There are two things that are in the photographs that are really indicate a point of entry. Number one, and I think the most telling, is going to be the avulsed wound. Because avulsed wounds are created when a projectile strikes the head on a tangent, on the curve. In other words, on the curve of the head, not on a flat on 90 degree to the head. And avulsions occur adjacent to the point of entry. And the other thing that is really interesting to see is that when you have a point of entry with high velocity, a lot of times you see this little splitting of the skin, and that is only found adjacent to the point of entry. So there are two things that really tell us that we have a front shot to the front portion of the head. And if you want to know exactly where Dr. Angel said that was located, it's going to be very surprising to you because so many people have pointed to this very same place as witnesses to the shooting or to President Kennedy after he was wounded. But if you kind of rub right above your brow, along the side of your face, above your eye, there you come across a little ridge. And if you follow that little ridge, it kind of goes up a little bit and towards, into the hairline. And just before the ear, along that little ridge, there is a particular point, and Dr. Angel said that is where he saw the beveling that he thought was the exit wound, which is in fact where everybody else now points to and says this is the entry wound.
Mm. And that is really one of the most interesting parts there, because see, I said this in, I think it was, I don't know, 2003 somewhere, when people were really starting to discuss the Clark panel, because previous to that, a lot of people had no clue that there was a re-examination of the medical evidence,
mm-hmm.
you know, in the late 60s. Everybody had thought that effectively, you know, the Warren Commission did their work, the HSCA did their work, and that was about it, except for, you know, the ARRB had gone back and recollected medical evidence without making any sort of commentary on it, but had recollected evidence, had re-interviewed a lot of people, to see if there was any sort of missed information regarding this, right? But I said back then that the Clark panel, I think, is the real landmine here for the official explanation, because these guys are going to wind up telling us a whole lot more truth than they ever intended.
That's exactly what happened. And that's what happened with Dr. Angel in 1982, because when he was looking at that in 1982, I mean, this guy was renowned in his field. I mean, he absolutely was a world-class anthropologist,
mm-hmm.
forensic anthropologist. And so when he sat on the House Select Committee's forensic pathology panel and he looked at that, which is called that point that he's talking about is a Stefan, when he said this defect is the exit wound, it became the official exit wound for the House Select Committee.
Mm.
The problem is he was going with beveling, and we now know that beveling is not acceptable as the only thing. And so in 1982, all this other information was available to him. And so he actually pointed out, and in a very specific way, the actual entry wound.
Right, and that's the most interesting thing. See, in the late 70s, he was correct for all intents and purposes regarding the scientific evidence, right?
Yes, he was.
But here's the problem, is that as we learn more, as science evolves, you know, it sometimes changes the conclusions. And this is precisely what happened regarding Dr. Angel's observations. And, of course, some of the more dramatic sort of illustrations out there, you know, not the Ida Dox drawings or the other ones that float around, but one of the ones that shows you the ejection of skull fragments out there is actually Dr. Angel's diagram regarding this, and a lot of people don't realize that as well. It's very basic looking. It's not the most, you know, exciting looking image out there, but it is one that does circulate now, and a lot of people have seized upon it to try and demonstrate something, but they don't understand it as you do. So,
well, here's one of the things that they look at that, and they say, well, we have skull bone fragments that have been deposited in front of President Kennedy. And so the gunshot has to come from the rear. And that's absolutely false. You cannot look at where bone is located once it's expelled from the head to determine in any possible way which direction the bullet was traveling when it struck the target.
Well,
you can't do it at all.
Right, because a lot of factors come into play here. I mean, I have talked about this, and again, not a forensic expert, but the simple idea of what they call a pressure cavity. That is formed, right, when a projectile goes through the skull, can cause bone to be ejected in all sorts of different ways, because basically, okay, this is real, please correct me, but the thing is, my understanding is that as the bullet would traverse, go into, you know, pass through the first piece of bone that it does and go into the brain, it is displacing the matter inside. So therefore, it's creating space where there wasn't space before. There was a very compact, closed area. Now, because it's creating space, the matter has to sort of move. So as the matter moves, it could create other fractures and things just in that moment, right? I mean, as it's traveling through the skull. I know that's really basic, but...
Well, that's how the concentric or the circular fractures are created, from that temporary cavitation.
Well, there you go. And this is part of the factor as to how the fragments, let's just say, of the bone could be ejected from the skull. And it doesn't necessarily mean that that has anything to do with the point of impact, the point of entry, the point of exit. It could just be that this is the amount of brain that has been, you know, moved around. And now that we have a fracture in another area, you have weaknesses that are radiating from that area where the impact is, right?
And a lot of it has to do with the scalp and how it tears. Let me just say this. If you put your hand flat on a table, and then imagine that there's pressure pushing against your hand. Now, if it's your right hand or whatever, let's say you start to lift the side of your thumb first. And as your hand rolls up, if you had momentum going, then it would peel off in a certain direction. Let's say that it happens your fingertips come off first. Then it would peel back towards you. The tearing of the skin is very random. And the thickness of the scalp is going to be a little different. And the thickness of the bones is going to be different. If your scalp is not a certain depth all the way around. All the bones are all different thicknesses. And so one may break away faster than another one. And so you get this peeling off and the ejecting, I'll get it out in a moment, of the bone fragments.
Right.
And they're in a very random manner. So you could have bone, as we do, ejected and land in front of President Kennedy looking at the Harper fragment. That's exactly what I'm talking about.
Well,
so,
there you go.
So can you say, this is where the Harper fragment was found, and so we know that if you have a shot from the front, that doesn't make sense. No, it makes perfect sense if you understand what happens to the head in a shooting.
And other factors that could change this, right? I mean,
exactly.
Again, correct me if I'm wrong, other factors that could put that Harper fragment in all sorts of different directions are right. that the health of the scalp, okay, we know that Kennedy had medical problems, right? So his actual skin health, you know, even though he looked pretty good, doesn't necessarily mean that that his skin was entirely healthy, okay? It might have actually been very easily torn, you know, depending, or maybe not. His age is another factor because someone at a certain age, their bones will fracture in a slightly different way, right? I mean, Kennedy's in his 40s.
Yeah, we really do not, you know, there's so many factors that we would have to consider. I don't think that we could really say, but what we can say with great certainty is that you can't look at where the bones were deposited and make a determination of where the shot originated from.
Mm. See, and that's the most fascinating thing here. Now, but like I said, you know, a lot of people do push back against the idea that there was a shot from the front, and they like to go along, and I'm going to bring it up again, the whole file scenario. If you can accept even, okay, like I said before, if you just accept where his position is supposed to be, okay,
mm-hmm.
There is virtually no evidence to support a shot from where he says he was, right? I mean, there's no shot from the side. Essentially, there's no grassy knoll shot that impacted Kennedy's skull.
You're absolutely correct.
Now, that's not to
there's
say...
There's nothing to support it.
Now, that's not to say that there is not the possibility that a shot could have been fired and missed, but to say that he actually was the one who, you know, caused the headshot is it's virtually inconsistent with every angle here regarding what can be examined forensically, right?
Absolutely. Listen, we know that we have these five things that I've talked about and cover in detail in my book: the beveling, fracture sequencing, the movement, the bullet fragment distribution, and the blood spatter. We know that the shot came from the front. The question becomes, what is front? And I'll tell you, in 1996, I thought front was the grassy knoll. Had I been to Dealey Plaza? Absolutely. I've been to Dealey Plaza a lot of times because my sister would drag me down there. Okay? I was familiar with it, believe me. But yet, when I reconstructed this from a forensic standpoint, I had to determine, number one, where is President Kennedy within Dealey Plaza, and what is his body position? Well, the first person to do that was Thomas Canning. He was an engineer with NASA, and he was engaged by the House Select Committee on Assassinations to conduct an analysis of exactly where President Kennedy was, not only within Dealey Plaza, but where was he facing. And so he did that, and he said that he was about 70 feet from Zapruder with almost a 90-degree angle, a 10-degree downward line of sight, and that Kennedy's head was turned away from Zapruder about 25 degrees beyond profile, that his head was tilted to the left at about 15 degrees and was nodding forward at about 11 degrees. Okay, and so that was what they used to position him. And then,
and this is the point. This is the point at which you can see on the Zapruder film where it appears.
You see that on the Zapruder film.
His hands, his hands are coming up. Okay,
they did it at frame 313, which was estimated at 0.055 seconds before the headshot. So, 0.5 of a second before the headshot,
right,
which is pretty precise. I think that you can definitely say this is the orientation of President Kennedy's head. So then Dale Myers comes along in 2004, and he did the same thing. Using a computer, he determined that Kennedy's head, relative to Zapruder at 312, was turned away at 25.7 degrees past profile, tilted to the left 18, turned away from Zapruder at profile 25.7, tilted to the left, and nodding down at 27.1 degrees. Now, he said his computer calculations had a 2-degree margin of error, and they were acceptable. So then in 2000, he won an Emmy in 2004. He did that 2 years before. In 2003, ABC News went to Z-Axis Corporation. Now, Z-Axis Corporation is the nation's leading forensic animation company. They're the ones that do all the major air crash litigations. They did Delta Flight 191 in Dallas. They did the U.S. air crash in Pittsburgh, the Korean Air 801 in Guam. They did Oklahoma City. I mean, these people know what they're doing. And ABC News hired them and said, I want you to look at this work of both, you know, what Thomas Canning did. I want you to look at what Dale Myers did and give us a report on it, because they wanted to know before he won that Emmy whether or not it was correct. And they came back and said that he had done an excellent job, and that from any point of view, there was absolute geometric integrity. And they published their report in 2003. So since then, other people have done this, but these are three really major and well-respected people that placed exactly where President Kennedy was looking. And guess where he's looking? He's not looking at the grassy knoll. He's looking at the south end of the triple overpass, almost where it intersects with that adjacent parking lot. So front is not the grassy knoll.
Right.
Front is the other side of Dealey Plaza. Now, the grassy knoll is to the side.
Now, before we get too much further into this, here's the thing. On your myths list, right, one of the myths here, and let's identify this, this is a myth. The single bullet theory is correct. Now, Dale Myers utilized his, you know, animation to say that the single bullet theory was correct.
Right.
But this is not the case. He may have gotten the headshot or the orientation of the head correctly.
But, you know, guess what? If you took Dale Myers' information and just flipped it in Dealey Plaza, guess where his trajectory cone would be?
Well, exactly
South
what you're talking about.
Exactly what I'm talking about. The only thing that he did was get the directionality wrong. But he doesn't. But listen, he's a computer animator. He's not a forensic scientist. He did not know about the fracture sequencing and the movements and the bullet fragment distribution and the blood spatter. He didn't know about all that. He just used what mathematic information that he had and what he was told, that it came from the rear. And so he applied what he could do and said it came from the rear. And he said, this is where it came from.
Well, right, but here's the problem with it again, that he utilized it to prove that the single bullet theory was correct. Now, there is a whole other.
Yeah, I don't think he did that. I don't think he actually proved that. I think he thinks he did, but I don't think he did.
Right, and here's the thing though. There are others that argue that it is the shot to the, you know, back of the neck, according to the official story, but what, you know, what I think is lower, based on what I've seen. That they say, well, maybe that is the bullet that traversed both Kennedy and Connolly. This doesn't work either, though, does it?
No, it really doesn't. It really doesn't. You know what was really interesting was when the House Select Committee asked Canning to come in, and they said, we want you to do a trajectory analysis for the single bullet to be able to prove the single bullet, and so he comes to the panel, and he's ready to do his demonstration, and he puts up these three projections or whatever, and he hadn't even gotten started yet, and this is a part of the record, and one of them say, wait a minute, why do you have three things for us to look at? And he says, because this is the quote. This is in the House Select Committee's report. We determined three trajectories in order to examine the validity of the single bullet theory that has received so much attention. In other words, he couldn't do it with one. He had to use three trajectories because that's what he found. And so he shows them this, but then he tells them, in order to make it work, what I'm going to do is I'm going to increase what we would normally use as a margin of error. And so when he did that, then he was able to say that he captured a portion of the window at the sixth floor that they referred to as a sniper's nest. And so, but what he really said in the beginning was that he thought it came from a point, the shooter was looking at President Kennedy, to the left and above that window, which means the building in the background, which is Daltech, and one of the higher floors.
Right.
And that's in the report. And, you know, and so he says all this. He does. But the problem is nothing lines up. Absolutely nothing lines up with the single bullet theory.
Let's just take that to its most absurd point, too, is that if you continuously increase the margins of error, eventually you could line it up to a helicopter that would be, hypothetically hovering over Dealey Plaza and somebody shot him from above. It's not a problem. You could continuously increase it and put that shooter anywhere, couldn't you?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so that's what they did. They just did that. And then finally they just eventually could not do anything any different. And so they said, you know what? This might be what you found out, but this is what our official finding is going to be. We can't really tell what their body position was. We don't know. They might have been moving around, bending over, doing something. And so therefore we're just going to say it works. We're just going to say that it works. But just to give you an example, the wound through Kennedy, the Warren Commission said was a 17-degree downward angle. The House Select Committee said was 25. But I'm talking about the throat wound.
Mm-hmm.
The pathologist that looked at the evidence said, no, 91 degrees. In other words, it's almost flat. Going from right to left, from the school book depository to Kennedy was a 26-degree angle, according to Canning, and through JFK at 18, through Connally at 12, and through to Connally 12, and through Connally at 27. So the same bullet travels at 26, 18, 12, and 27 degrees left to right, and then Shaw, who was the surgeon for Connally, says, nope, it was 13. So really, five different angles between 12 and 27.
Well,
for the same little short period. So you know it doesn't work.
No, it's too drastic. You would have deviations, okay, with a projectile. There are possibilities of deviations. It's not necessarily going to be a perfectly straight line. But the deviations
are closer than that.
They are too sharp. There's too much of a difference, right?
That's right.
Okay. You know, look, and here I am, like I said before, I'm not somebody who's an expert on this, but it just seems to me that common sense would tell you that, you know, that's a little too much movement for that bullet.
Exactly.
You can't make a bullet do that. I mean, it would be the amount of, like, say, deflection or change in directionality is virtually impossible. You know?
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that.
So there you go with another one of these myths. And I'll tell you something. We've actually covered a whole bunch of the myths here just in discussing this organically. I'll start from the bottom of the list. Like I said before, the single bullet theory is correct. This is a myth. We just covered that. There are two simultaneous headshots. We have covered that. The fatal headshot originated from the grassy knoll. We've covered that. Okay, here's one we haven't covered. Okay, the limousine stopped. Now, a lot of people utilize this. They say, you know, because of testimony mm-hmm. from different individuals, and they say that this is proof positive that the Zapruder film has been, fabricated. Do I think that parts of it may have been tampered with? Yes, I do. But fabricated in whole and having a limousine stop removed from it? No. This was not done. There is an impression, I believe, and I'm just going to give you my belief about this, and you could tell me I'm wrong, but I think that there is an impression among some eyewitnesses that the limousine stopped because there was a jerking of the brakes, it seems, by the driver at a certain point. And I think that, the nature of eyewitness testimony as it is in one of those fluid situations causes them to think that there may have been something like a stop because of a sort of a tapping on the brakes, which you can see evidenced in the Zapruder film, because if you ever take a look at the brake lights, instead of watching Kennedy's head, just take a look at the brake lights, you can see them come on, okay? Now, that's what I see. Maybe I'm wrong. But, you know, again, the blind guy, so maybe I'm off, okay? But I think that's what happened there, and we're not looking at a stopped limousine that's been, you know, edited out of the film.
I want to offer another reason.
Okay.
Okay, in addition to that. And I want to start by asking you a question. If I ask you how long it takes you to get up in the morning and get dressed, how long does it take you? You know, don't you?
Hmm.
You know how long it takes you to do that.
Sure.
All right. We have a perception of time based on experience. And the way that the brain works is, you know, we all have an internal clock. Have you ever said, I wonder what time is it? It must be about 4. You look at your watch and it's like 4:05. Something like that. We have a general idea of the passage of time because we know how long it takes us to do things. So if we're watching the news and we stop and then we decide to go out and we walk the dog and we walk to a certain place every time and we come back, we know how much time has passed because we've done it before. What the brain does is that our unconscious mind is aware of the passage of time, even when we're sleeping. So sometimes people wake up just before the alarm goes off.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, has that ever happened to you?
Sure, all the time.
That's right. Because we have that internal clock. And it detects for us a passage of time. And that internal clock is called a pacemaker. Okay?
Okay.
Because that internal clock is beating minutes by at a certain pace. Now, over time, we get to anticipate how long it takes to do things because we've done something before or something similar to before. And so we can develop or calculate a sense of passing time. So if we lay down, you can, and you fall asleep and you can wake up and say, oh man, I've probably been sleeping for about 30 minutes or whatever. Okay. And the way that we do that is that the brain equates the number or the amount of data that we receive as representative of a certain time period.
Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, research has shown that when we are in moments of extreme stress or life-threatening situations, we have heightened concentration and we fix our attention very, very, in a very focused way. And when that happens, we can take in more data than we normally get in because we're not distracted by other things. Because even as we are sitting here talking right now, you are probably thinking about, well, what is the next question that I can ask her? At the same time, you're listening to me, and then you're looking at the clock and thinking, ah, this is how many minutes that I have left, and these are the things I want to cover. Mm-hmm. And then when we finish, first thing I want to do is go get something to drink or whatever.
Right.
Because our mind can do all these things. But what if the only single thing that you were thinking about was one? Then you would be paying very close attention. Maybe you would be listening to me and what I'm saying, and maybe you would think about every syllable and how I say my words and the words that I choose and the accent that I have, and all of those things would become much more significant to you. And when that happens to us, our pacemaker says, I'm getting too much information.
Hmm.
I need to fix this. Either I'm off or more time has passed than I think. And the brain identifies that passage of time and changes it for us to time dilation. So what happens is we have the perception of experiencing a longer interval of time. A great example of that. People get in a car accident, And they say it was like it was in slow motion. I could see the car coming, but there was nothing I could do. I looked over and I saw my daughter in the car seat. She looked okay. I just closed my eyes and gripped the wheel. And they talk about all the things that they did and that they saw. But the reality is, it was a heartbeat. It was just like that.
Right. It happened in a snap moment.
That's right.
Yeah. And that's,
but for them, it seemed like it took such a long time because they took in so much information. There is a very well-known example of this. And there was some people that did, they studied officer-involved shootings. And the guy's name was Alex Artwall, and the title of it was Perceptual and Memory Distortion During Officer-Involved Shootings. And he had the story that this guy gave him where he's in a shootout and he is with his partner, and he sees beer cans floating through the air in an arc in front of him, and he reads what's on the bottom of the beer can, and it says Federal. And he thinks to himself, I've never heard of Federal beer. Do you know what he was seeing? He was seeing the casings as they were being ejected from his partner's semi-automatic weapon.
Mm.
Now, that kind of focus and attention is what happens when people are in that kind of environment. So, you look at the people that were closest, that thought maybe they would be shot, and they had that slow down in time, and the only way that they can explain it is to say that the vehicle stopped. A great example of that is Bill Newman.
Well, right, and here's the really fascinating part of that, because people say, well, you know, you can't rely on these witnesses because they're so inconsistent. But here's the thing. The actualization from each one of these people is different. Some of them had no idea what was going on as it was going on.
Mm-hmm.
And I know this from speaking to witnesses. They didn't know anything. They're filling in the blanks later, which is a whole other memory phenomena, which causes them to not see that stop, as it were. But what it is it's a reinterpretation, again, of what I think is a jerking on of the brake really quickly. And like you said, it slows down time when you're in a high-stress situation. Mm-hmm. I mean, this is precisely what it is I have said for years, you know, regarding this. But, of course, you just explained it, you know, real well. But, I mean, I'm just saying that this is my observation. But there were individuals there that say they didn't see this limo stop, and why didn't they see the limo stop? Are they lying? No, they're not lying either. They just did not have the stress that caused them to focus in that way because they didn't realize that those pops were gunshots. They didn't realize what was happening, until afterwards. So maybe when they fell on the ground, they remembered the blades of grass very, very well, because mm-hmm. that's the point at which their brain kicked in and did that whole process you were talking about.
Right.
And this is what happens here, and this is why it's so difficult to sort through just the eyewitness testimony, because people do focus on just the eyewitness testimony, and it's not enough to tell the whole story that way, and it's not enough to sit there and invalidate something like the Zapruder film in its in its entirety based on eyewitness testimony, because there are things that the brain does to memory that film does not enjoy. Okay?
Exactly.
It's just that simple. Your mind also will take new facts that you've learned later, even though you observed a situation firsthand, right?
Mm-hmm.
Your mind will also add in things later on because you've actually collected some other data.
You know, I witnessed a traffic accident one time. As a police officer, I witnessed it. And so, of course, I had to write a statement that I had seen it. And in my statement, I reversed the direction that the car that was in the wrong, that struck another vehicle,
mm-hmm.
was traveling from. And I actually wrote it down in the report, and they came back to me and said, you know, this is wrong. And I said, no, it's not. I know what I saw. I was convinced that I was correct. I wasn't.
Mm.
I absolutely wasn't. I mean, that was a real eye-opener for me. But, you know, what Bill Newman described, when I talked to him personally, he told me, he said the car was about 10 feet away from him. He heard the third shot, and the side of his head flew off. He said, I remembered seeing blood in front of his face. It was a very fine red mist, like a cloud of blood. about 2 feet or so in diameter in front of his face, and then it just disappeared. And then he also said in Crossfire, the plot that killed Kennedy by Jim Mars, that the car stopped momentarily, and the driver seemed to have a radio or a phone to his ear and seemed to be waiting on some word, and Secret Service man reached into their car and came out with some kind of machine gun, and then they roared off. And I've maintained that the car stopped. I still say they did. It was only a momentary stop. If you look at the Zapruder film, every single thing that he describes happens between 313 and 345. The Zapruder film is filmed at 18.3 frames per second. So everything that he saw happened in 1.77 seconds, not even 2 seconds.
Right, and just to clarify for people who Bill Newman is, okay, this is the gentleman that we most famously see laying on the ground next to his wife, Gail. They're both covering children on the knoll, as it were. And they were practically the closest people to the, maybe not the closest, but one of the closest people to the events as they were unfolding, as Kennedy was mm-hmm. being shot. And his testimony is a little bit odd because there are a lot of strange anomalies in there that seem like he couldn't have possibly observed this or that. He mentioned for many years before seeing the Zapruder film himself that it seemed as though Kennedy had kind of jumped up in his seat.
Mm-hmm.
This is his interpretation of a very split-second event, which is the violent head snap. Essentially, from his angle, it would appear as though Kennedy was coming up because, as you stated earlier, he's leaning forward.
Right.
See, this is explainable. It's not a matter of that his memory is wrong, but again, as you stated, that phenomenon where time is slowed down, Newman experienced that.
He did.
And this is what happened. Now, of course, it was a high-stress situation because he realized it was gunshots. He was looking to defend his children, was worried about his wife. Okay, this is a young man. Maybe a heightened sensitivity might have been there because of his very young age at the time, even. Okay, there's a lot of factors go into that. But here's the thing. It's not that any of what he had to say is invalid in any way, shape, or form. It's just that his interpretation is the problem.
Exactly.
So that kind of jerking movement that I'm describing, where there's the tap on the brakes, right, could be interpreted by him as a complete stop because time sort of slowed down for him.
It did. I believe that it did. And I think I will say this, for every single witness, and I know and have met a lot of the witnesses. I mean, really, I have.
Mm-hmm.
People that were actually there in Dealey Plaza and had a wonderful opportunity to speak with them. Every single one of them, I believe, are telling the truth. That is, even if it can be shown in conflict with something else, it's their truth. I do not think any witnesses are lying or trying to misrepresent or anything. But I think, just like I thought that car was coming from a different direction, I think that, and I'm, hello, supposed to be a trained observer. Okay, mm-hmm. I was working as a police officer during that time, and I got it wrong. And I was convinced. And to this day, I still remember it like that. And so why would we doubt what they're saying? But witness testimony is not always the most reliable. And so that's why we have to look at other things, too. And so we can look at other things. We look at the Zapruder film, the Nix film, much more. And, Bronson, and a scientific analysis was done by a physicist, Luis Alvarez.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, he received the Nobel Peace Prize in 1968. This guy, we're not talking about some little Joe Blow that worked at a college somewhere and, I know math and let me do this. No, this guy was prestigious and one of the most influential physicists of the 20th century. And he said that the limousine, from everything that he was able to look at, did not stop, but it just slowed from about 12 to 8 miles an hour. And it was peer-reviewed by 3 other scientists, and that information was all made public with the House Select Committee. So I don't think that we can say that the limousine stopped. I think that we are accurate in saying that it slowed and may have been perceived as coming to a stop by some people.
Well, right, and that's exactly the point here, and that's why, even though I hate to agree with a guy like Alvarez, who was on record pretty much agreeing with the single shooter, you know, and all of that, you know, he was correct about this.
That
reduction in speed can be explained exactly like the way I explained it, which, of course, is, you know, kind of half-baked, but the fact is you can see the brake lights. So,
yeah.
So
absolutely.
There
and, you
go.
I don't think that that's unusual. I'm going to tell you, you know, I've had children in the back seat with me, and they are fussing or something, and I will tap my brake and turn around and look at them and say, what are y'all doing, and do you want to have a spanking? You know, that kind of thing. I mean, we do things like that. People do things like that.
Well, right.
We tap the brake. We slow down so that we can turn around and look. Even if we're going slow already, we just do that. We put the foot on the brake for a moment and turn around. So it's not surprising to me that happened, and whether or not the vehicle stopped, it has nothing to do with making it easier for someone to shoot the president, which is something that I hear all the time, too, and it really doesn't, because President Kennedy was moving directly towards the shooter, and so the speed of the limousine would make absolutely no difference, absolutely none.
No, and that's the other problem. And of course, you know, you can actually kind of get a good measurement of this. I've seen this done, and I haven't seen it published yet, so I'm not going to reveal who's doing it. But they were looking at the Daniels film, you know, the Jack Daniel film, which is the limousine coming out from under the overpass and passing the lead car and all that.
Right.
For those who don't know it, and you can actually determine how slow that vehicle was moving versus them accelerating at that point in time, and you can sort of see what happened there. You know, even from that film, you can glean certain information. I was kind of disappointed to not find a shooter in that film, to be honest with you, during this analysis I'm privy to. But either way, I absolutely agree, you know, with everything you said. Now, we're like down to less than 15 minutes, okay? So I want to finish covering the list of myths here, and then kind of give you a final sort of thoughts, and tell everybody again where they can get your book, and you know, you're also working on another book too. So let's see if we can fit all this in.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. Ballistic tests prove a single shooter. Well, we kind of went over that. We have too many trajectories here to have a single point of emergence for the shots. Okay, so we went over that. The Blood in the Zapruder Home movie is faked. We've been over that optically, and then of course, if you have a better copy, you can see that it's a whole lot more characteristic of what's realistic and is expected. Ear witnesses are reliable. We've gone over perception here already for witnesses. So what they heard could be exactly the same sort of thing as, you know, what they saw. They have a heightened or a lowered sense of observation based on their level of anxiety, to put it one way anyway. So you have all sorts of different perceptions, not to mention the physical fact that, you know, there's plenty of echoes and things to be had in Dealey Plaza. It's a small area, you know, and depending on where you're positioned, I mean, you can get different echo effects. So ear witnesses are a problem right there, so they're not reliable as far as making any sort of definitive determination. Okay. Dallas Police Department followed protocol. Wow. They didn't even remotely do that, did they?
No, they didn't. We could do a whole show just on that. I mean, we could talk about it for 2 hours. It is so bad. They did so many things that were wrong. But the thing I want to tell you is that I hear people tell me all the time, well, you shouldn't hold them to the same standards that we have now. No, and I don't. But what I would like to do is hold them to the standards that were in place in 1963. And if we do that, they missed in every possible way. They did not do one thing correct. In 1963, there were 7 things that they were supposed to do. The standards for national investigation of crime scenes had been established in 1953, 10 years previous.
Mm-hmm.
And the 7 things that they were supposed to do, they did none of them. Not one. Not one of the 7 things that they were supposed to do did they do correctly. And they should have known, because I'm going to tell you, in 1963, Dallas had led the nation in homicides for 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like they didn't work homicides. And Day talked about the training and stuff that he had. I mean, I think that they had confirmation bias. I think they went in and they said, we know what happened and, you know, we're just going to go with that and prove our case and not really look at what the, where the evidence leads us. The other thing that they did was they allowed someone with no training to be in charge. I mean, how crazy was that? You had someone that had been with them for 6 weeks, and they determined what was going to happen in the crime scene. Everybody else with experience walked out. And then, of course, they were used to making them. Their great majority of cases weren't made on evidence. They were actually made from interrogations. And I have to say that they were great at it. Fritz was absolutely fabulous investigator when it came to interrogating people and getting the information that he needed. But they ignored everything that they were supposed to do from the top down. I mean, even with Fritz going in, and we know that he picked up the casings and held them in his hand before they were ever photographed or anything. We have that information. We know that that's true, and testimony to support that they had been moved. And then we have other people testifying that it had not been moved when we know that they were lying under oath. I mean, the things that they did wrong are just absolutely unbelievable.
Well, let me run this by you, because here's what my problem is with the Dallas police and what I discovered by talking to them. Okay? And you can explain exactly why I'm so revolted by this from the standpoint of somebody who's worked in law enforcement. Okay? Here's the thing. A lot of the reports that we have, a lot of the records, okay, we'll leave Fritz alone. Yes, he was a legendary interrogator, okay, but his record keeping was horrible.
Yes.
Okay, and worse than that, every single one of the people that was involved in the investigation, it seems to me, I mean, well, wait, let me dial that back. Not everyone, but way too many of them that were filing these affidavits, okay, what they saw, what they experienced, what they took down and they noticed, in a lot of cases, okay, you have one guy writing a report for another guy. You mm-hmm. have them, like, yeah, I wrote the report. I mean, I had these guys admit this to me, that, yeah, well, we did that all the time. You know, a couple of us would be there, and one guy would write the report. And I didn't necessarily see that, but I was with this guy who saw it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I'm like, well, you're giving an affidavit to what you observed as a law enforcement officer, okay, based on what this other law enforcement officer is saying. I don't know, maybe it's just because I'm a little crazy, but isn't that sort of like hearsay evidence, you know?
Yeah. I mean, really, what they should have been doing was, as far as the reports go, they should have been taking rough notes themselves, and then they should have finalized that as an investigative report as soon as possible and had the most detailed, comprehensive, accurate report as possible. But you're right. I mean, all of the reports were absolutely terrible. I mean, even Lieutenant Day, can you imagine that he writes a report on the death of a sitting president,
mm-hmm.
and his report is made up of 10 points and less than 700 words.
Right. The guy
less who, than 700. Yes, this is the crime scene investigative report for the homicide of President John F. Kennedy in less than 700 words.
Well, yeah, and also this is the guy who, has the alleged murder weapon in his hands.
Right. Can't keep up with the casings, you know, they don't know what happened to everything. The book cartons were moved, and, I mean, he actually gets up and testifies, well, this is not what they look, and they ask him, how do you explain these two photographs? Nothing. They said nothing was moved, and the photographs don't match. How do you explain that? He says, I don't know how to explain that. I guess they were moved. So then they question the person that they know moved them. They have other testimony that he moved them. And he says, no, I didn't move anything. I mean, yeah. Studebaker says that. So, I mean, people were perjuring themselves like crazy. I mean, it was just an absolute mess. I don't know what else to say about it. It was just an absolute mess. I mean, I don't know why they did such a poor, poor job. I mean, it was just really bad. It compromised evidence, evidence collected that we have no clue what happened to it. I mean, for instance, the window seal at the window where the shooter would have been located, that wood was collected.
Mm-hmm.
We know it was collected. We know it was turned over to the FBI. We don't know anything else after that. Nothing.
No, and a lot of the evidence actually disappeared.
Yes.
Was misnumbered.
Missing.
Missing. They wind up collecting one of the casings weeks later. You know.
I know. I mean,
it's
absolutely
all over the place.
It's just a big mess. I mean, they did so many. The integrity of evidence was just not maintained, and you know, so many testimonies and reports that contradict each other and just don't make sense. It's just a mess. I think that, you know, people become under stress, mm-hmm. habits come out,
mm-hmm.
and you just do whatever you're used to doing. I mean, let's talk about this. If you're in the car and someone pulls out in front of you, you do not actually think to yourself, let me apply the brake. You just do it.
Right.
Because you're under stress. And I think that a lot of it may have had that their habits were just so poor. They knew what they were supposed to do. But unfortunately, I think that the stress that they were under prompted habitual behavior. And they did crazy stuff that was counterproductive to what they might have wanted to do.
Right, and this at the end of the day is really what results, you know, from those who want to go back and say, you know, things like, because I've heard some laughable statements, the Dallas police actually did a really good investigation.
Oh, my God.
I cannot, and again, I'm not in law enforcement, but I look at it and I say, just based on the contradictions, the terrible chain of evidence, mm-hmm. You know, the misunderstanding, mislabeling, and misreporting of all of the, you know, not all, but of so many of the individuals that had their hands in this investigation, you have something that is indecipherable at this point,
mm-hmm.
Regarding, you know, the true, you know, actual arc of events that occurred here. So look, we're down to the last 3 minutes or so. And again, I want you to give out the name of your book and also tell people about what it is you're working on coming up as well. So once again, the name of your book and CherryFeaster.com, and that's spelled FIESTER. Okay,
right.
Just so everybody knows, and you can find a lot of information there, especially about the book. But of course, go ahead and tell us the title.
The title of the book is "Enemy of the Truth: Myths, Forensics, and the Kennedy Assassination." And you can get it on Amazon, but if you get it through CherryFeaster.com, I'll sign it to you. And so I really sell a lot more there than on Amazon because people want me to write something to them, you know, so that's what I do.
Well, you know, and I do want to thank you for joining us tonight because this has been really, really interesting and enlightening, and I'm extremely glad that we did this because this is the kind of stuff that I try and speak about because I understand what's going on, but I can't necessarily verbalize it all regarding this stuff, and sometimes I apply, you know, the things that I've learned, you know, via the Kennedy assassination over the years and as the science has evolved to try and explain a lot of other things, and I got to tell you, the science doesn't fool us at this point. You know what I mean? The science really mm-hmm. does reveal a lot of the BS in the stories that travel. So I'm really, really glad that we did this tonight. If you wouldn't mind, in the last little bit here, I mean, tell everybody about what you're working on now.
I'm working on a book called Marionettes, Mind Control in America, or Understanding Mind Control, or something similar to that. I haven't actually got the tight title on it yet, but it's three parts. The first part talks about the puppet masters and its people that use mind control, and the second section is called Pulling the Strings, and it talks about how mind control is actually accomplished by these people, and the third section is called The Marionettes, and it's the victims of mind control. So it's pretty interesting for me to write. I hope that people enjoy reading it.
Absolutely, and I hope that you'll come back on and we can talk about that particular book, because that is an area of interest for me as well. Of course, not as big as the Kennedy assassination is to me, as everybody who listens to me knows, but even so, I definitely would love to delve into that subject with you, because you know, you're absolutely absolutely spot on when it comes to the scientific nature of the way we can examine evidence all around regarding any of these events of interest in our history. And you know what? If we all had the knowledge you have, it would be a hell of a lot harder for them to lie to us. So so I'll tell you this. I want to thank everybody who tuned in. Have a good night, and we will see you on Saturday.
At the age of 19 in 1962, she was a...
See, but I have the files. You know, I read this
really?
Stuff at the National Archives, and I read these other things.
I said to
myself,
how can that be possible?
The brain, you know, the
fondle
slap of choice. I don't know when that was. It doesn't really matter.
Internet,
yeah,
okay.
Professional
wrestlers,
and not just even tourist style.
It doesn't matter where the
information comes from, as long as it's real.
It doesn't take
hard to get real with these
nations. Because seriously,
oh, you know what you have to do.